Hey everybody, and welcome to another exciting and jam-packed episode of Modern Day Philosophers. I am your host, Danny Lobel. You're the listeners out there tuning in on your phones, on your iPods, on your computers, wherever you may be, listening to the show, and I appreciate you for it. Of course, you can always donate to the show at www.moderndayphilosophers.net. If you donate $20 or more, I will send you some Tweaked Audio earbuds. They are wonderful. You can also pick them up at their website, tweakedaudio.com. And if you put in promo code MDP, short for Modern Day Philosophers, you will get 1/3 off your order. Now, today's episode is brought to you by a wonderful sponsor. You know him, you love him. It's standupcrap.com. The wonderful Mr. Dan Schlissel keeps this show a-going by supporting it. And please go and support him in return. Go to standupcrap.com. Go pick up CDs, vinyl records, DVDs, t-shirts, a wide variety of other merchandise. Write direct from one of the best and most prolific comedy labels out there. Visit standupcrap.com today. Go get yourself some Marc Maron, Lewis Black, Maria Bamford, Danny Lobel. Hey, come on, Brendan Burns. Pick up some albums. Go get my album, Some Kind of Comedian. It's all up there on the Stand Up Records label, and it's all for discounted prices at standupcrap.com. Standupcrap.com, standupcrap.com. I hope everybody had a great 4th of July. I did. I really enjoyed it. It's been a stressful week, but it ended well. Somebody left the door open. My tortoise was gone. It's the third time this has happened in the course of 2 years, but I've gotten him back every time. I'm happy to say this time was the longest he's ever been gone for. He was gone for 5 days before I got him back. I had to put lost tortoise signs up in the neighborhood, which is always, well, I'll put it like this. You get made fun of, people think it's a hipster prank. But it worked. 5 days later, somebody in the neighborhood said they found my tortoise. They took him in. They saw the sign. They called me up. I went over. I gave him a $20 reward. It was worth every penny, and I got my little buddy back. My tortoise is home. He's back. Mr. Tenenbaum. That's what we call him. Mr. Tenenbaum. He's home. But I'll tell you, it was stressful, and then once we got him back, funny, because we still get phone calls from the signs in the neighborhood. I got a call from a mail lady who said, yeah, I think I saw your tortoise go by, but I couldn't get him in time. And that is proof, folks, that the mail moves slow. Am I right? Give me a drum. But seriously, come on. All right, let's get to the episode. I'm in a good mood today. I'm happy to have you guys here. It's a great episode. I'm excited for you to hear it. Cliff Nesteroff, he's a writer. He's got a book coming out called Drunks, Thieves, and Scoundrels, I think is the working title. It's going to be available in a year. It's the history of American comedy. And here's my talk with him. Wait a minute, right after the intro song. Enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to Modern Day Philosophers.
Modern Day Philosophers.
Having failed to pay attention in school, Danny Lobel, now older and wiser, will attempt to learn basic philosophy 101. Our young hero will be joined by today's top comedians, philosophers all their own. Ladies and gentlemen, here's Danny Lobel!
Modern Day Philosophers.
I'm talking in the Lobel House production studio, my upstairs, with Cliff Nesteroff. How are you, Cliff?
I'm excellent. Thank you, Danny, for bringing me to the estate, Lobel Manor.
It's quite a neighborhood, isn't it?
This is one of the seldom podcast studios that actually has a view.
Yeah, I insist upon a view.
So that's kind of nice. You can see to the west, you can see the financial center of Beverly Hills. And directly across from us, we can see a house with laundry strewn about a chain link fence.
I like how you're painting the picture for the listener.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's not often you have the chance. Usually it's just a podcast studio, four walls, no windows.
I guess it's a metaphor too, you know? It's the podcast connecting to the greater world.
Well, let's not push it. But but it's nice to have a view.
Look out at the people that we can influence with these words.
I got a feeling that neighbor with the laundry strewn about the chain link fence has never downloaded your show. I'm just guessing.
I'm going to have to let them know about it. It's just about getting the word out.
Yeah. Start local.
Yeah. I'm wondering about where that comes from, getting the word out.
Like a town crier. Somebody standing on a corner shouting, all is well. I got to get the word out. It's 12 o'clock and all is well. I bet it comes from that. Or 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock, whatever the time that it was well at. You never hear about the town crier yelling out when it wasn't well, though.
And it's only one word. It should be, I want to get the words out.
Yeah. Yeah, where did the abbreviation come from? It was only one word.
One word.
Excelsior. Isn't that what Stan Lee used to say?
Is it?
I mean, it was like his one word exclamation. No,
okay. I didn't know that.
It doesn't matter.
It matters.
It doesn't.
It matters.
No, it doesn't. It
matters to someone.
Yeah, but we don't need to associate with those people who think the one word that Stan Lee says matters. That's why I don't go to Comic-Con.
those people, you can't get the word out to them.
There's no need. The word is magic cards at 5 p.m. in the back of the comic store.
Hasn't the word always been out?
Well, as a writer, if I were to assume that the word has already gotten out, then it negates my whole purpose. So I would say, no, there's more words to get out there.
Yeah, but the words haven't gotten out, but the word has always been out.
The word has always been out, although they always add new words to the dictionary every every year. It's always a news story about the new words that have been added. Ginormous was added officially to I guess a year and a half ago, 2 years ago now. Yeah, words like that enter the lexicon and everybody uses, but they're not really words, eventually get accepted as words.
And then so there's some kind of committee out Scrabble. There. I think that's the big...
Yes, yeah. It's a conspiracy. People see how many points they could get with these new words and then determine that they're officially words.
I wonder who gets to be on the board of people who pick if it's a word or not. That's a very powerful...
Well, that is a good question, but I'm sure it's the Carlyle group or the Brandenburg group, and they meet in a secluded Lake Louise-type setting and conspire.
Lake Louise.
I'm sure Karl Rove has a hand in which words, in ginormous and so on.
I'd like to sit in on that sometime.
Yeah.
You know, just sit in and watch these guys.
Get podcast credentials.
Yeah, they're ginormous. A lot of people are using it now. A lot of the youth, they seem to... We'll play some of the footage when they roll down a projector and then they have some kids on college campuses.
Right.
Wow, that shit was ginormous.
Right, clips from MTV's The Real World.
Right.
In which these... words have been bandied about.
A bunch of these guys just stroke their long beards and they say, let's think on it for the day. And they meditate and they re-adjourn it that evening.
I could be wrong, but I think that Noah Webster, the guy who founded Webster's Dictionary, I think he had a long beard.
Yeah?
I think so. At least I've seen him spoofed in like cartoons and he's stroking this big long white beard, Noah Webster.
It's just full of words. Yes. Little words crafted into
Beard. Yeah, yeah. He's a completely disgusting human being. Totally unhygienic.
Hey, you've got words in your beard.
You've got alphabet soup in your facial hair again. Disgusting human being, Noah Webster.
What about when they say it's not a word? That's got to be a harsh moment for that word. Because the word, I guess
it's a majority rule. It's the eyes have it, I would guess. We're completely speculating here.
Yeah.
This is all conjecture. We have no idea what goes on behind those doors at the Webster Institute.
But these people.
Those think tanks that decide.
They're affecting your life more than most people's as a writer. They're deciding tools you have.
Once you get to a certain level as a writer, and I haven't gotten there yet, but you can actually dictate what language is to a certain degree. It's up to you what you capitalize and what you don't. It's not like being in school where you're told you can't capitalize that.
When you become a writing Buddha.
Well, in my manuscript, for instance, I capitalize black in reference to black people. The B is always capitalized, but if you go by conventional... rules of order, you're not supposed to capitalize black, you capitalize African-American, you capitalize a lot of other names in reference to groups of people, but you never capitalize black for whatever reason. That's never caught on.
But you said, no, fuck it.
I said it should be capitalized. Yeah. Why would it not be capitalized? Black people, it should be a capital B. So all through my manuscript, that's what I do. And I don't know if my editor will change that or not, but I would fight to keep that B.
Them.
And I would expect that eventually that would be adopted as like a commonality. I would hope so or expect to.
I like that you're fighting for the black people in a way, you know? You're fighting
doesn't that make logical sense? When I was in elementary school, they would tell you why things were capitalized and why they weren't.
Mm-hmm.
And they would say, you know, a capital letter usually means that it's an important name of some kind. It's a proper name.
Sure.
It's the name of a city. It's the name of a place, or it's the name of a event. Like World War II is capitalized in literature or in nonfiction. It's something of magnitude. It's an event. The Great Depression is usually capitalized. So it makes no sense to me why black people, if you're using that term of reference regularly, it doesn't make any sense to me why that wouldn't be capitalized. So I capitalize it.
In a way, you're a civil rights leader. Not leader, but at least fighter.
Yeah,
right?
It's me, it's Dick Gregory, And that's it. We're the last two left.
You're making one of the last tweaks to the civil rights movement that needed to be made.
That's right. It'll be all... The Supreme Court, I think, recently said that racism is over. They eliminated the Civil Rights Voting Act of 1965. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's over. As soon as I get this capitalized, it's full equality across America. As this neighborhood demonstrates, mm-hmm. there is no disparity of any kind in income, race, or class in America.
Yeah, well, that's the one thing Obama couldn't do for black people. Cliff Nesteroff is picking up the slack.
It took a white Canadian boy
to
come down to America. And
one more wrong must be righted.
Correct, yeah.
And written, right, written.
Microsoft Word spell check be damned. That racist red underline is not going to stop me.
So these people who sit there in
it's
a
just
room
turned into a right wing podcast.
These people who sit there in a room or by a lake and decide which words are real words,
right,
are in a way crafting the tools of writers, unbeknownst to them, probably, right?
Probably.
It's almost as if the equivalent for a painter would be if there were a bunch of people that could decide on a new color paint.
Right.
You know, or a new brush or a new tool that a painter can use that wouldn't be allowed otherwise.
Yeah, yeah. Like what if they did discover a new color?
I've often thought about that.
The other thing about that, I've always wondered, maybe this is like a stupid, childish idea, but I always wondered this when I was a kid. I still wonder it. How do we know that we all see the same color? Like we all identify blue as blue, but mm-hmm. maybe what I see as blue is what you actually see as green, and what I see as green, and vice versa. You know, we can't see behind each other's eyes to know. I always wondered that.
I've gotten stuck in that one too.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no. There's
no Roy G. Biv answer to that.
Well, what about this? Even if everybody sees the same colors as you see them. The emotions that those colors evoke based on memories and past experiences of any kind, you know.
You get emotional when you see colors, Danny?
Sure. And people
Which
have
one?
Some you ever
Which
heard
color?
Of have you heard of synesthesia?
No.
Synesthesia is certain people relate to emotions in colors. So they might see certain things as different colors, like an energy.
Right.
I'm going to look it up so I can exactly tell you what it is, because it's interesting and it relates.
Sounds LSD inspired.
Synesthesia is a neurological phenomenon in which stimulation of one sensory or cognitive pathway leads to automatic involuntary experiences in a second sensory or cognitive pathway. People who report such experiences are known as synesthesia. Anyway, in one common form of synesthesia, known as grapheme, I think that's how you'd say that, which is color synesthesia or color graphemic synesthesia, letters or numbers are perceived as inherently colored. Anyway, people see certain letters. Like, take a look at these letters and numbers and synesthesia here.
You lost me after the first mention of synesthesia.
I lost myself there, too.
Yeah, I stopped listening. But it sounds very acid-influenced. I think the Wikipedia author is a big adherent of the psilocybin effects.
But the reason I know about this also is I have a friend who has synesthesia.
How much acid has he done in his life?
I would say none.
Really?
Yeah.
How much knowing mescaline? Him. Peyote?
He's...
Morning glory seeds? How many morning glory seeds?
I don't know.
Intentionally or accidentally?
I haven't been in touch with him, so maybe now he has. But I know him as a kid having synesthesia, so I mean...
His parents did a lot of acid.
Yeah, his parents.
I'm telling you.
I love that you're sticking to... And he's a musician, so maybe by now he has done it.
Yeah,
but
but
he was saying like the different notes strike him as different colors.
Right. Yeah, that's an acid thing. It was like the LSD cliche that you could see and hear colors. But that's okay. I'm into that. That's cool.
You know, when people say you're feeling pretty blue, that evokes
seeing
emotion.
Right.
So, I mean, I guess different colors strike people in different ways, too.
Right. So what's the color that makes you emote the most, you don't have synesthesia, but right. you say that you, certain colors trigger certain emotions in you. Which ones? And what?
Here's the thing. When you're a kid, you're asked to pick a favorite color, which is an interesting question. Right.
It's demanded of you as a child in society.
What's your favorite color? So I don't know what that means, but I guess I always picked green, and I still like green the best. I guess green is nature. Green is growth. Green is life. Almost.
It's also an effective marketing tool for like kitchen and bathroom cleaning chemicals. They just put the word green on it, and then suddenly you'll buy it. Go, oh, this isn't bleach that I'm pouring down my drain.
Right, right. But yeah, that's the idea. I mean, everybody wants to go green now. I think I was ahead of the curve on
right,
that.
Right, right, right.
As a kid, nobody cared about going green but me.
Except for Earth Day. Remember Earth Day? The Sweeps Week specials they used to have like on ABC in like 1993. Earth Day.
Forgot about
and
Earth
they'd bring
Day.
Together like Kirk Cameron would team up with Bob Saget, you know, and all the sitcom stars. It's Earth Day. And they talk about recycling your bottles. And then there'd be a song performed by Milli Vanilli.
Or by Biggie, right? Earth Days were the worst days.
Sounds like a Great Depression song. Earth Days were the worst days, but days are getting better. Yeah. Well, I remember Earth Day. You were allowed to care about green stuff like once a year.
Yeah.
It's amazing that recycling, that it actually became a thing. Like in our lifetime, that became a thing.
You didn't think it would take off?
Now it's like really common. Like everywhere you go, there's a recycling bin or a box or whatever. But once upon a time, that wasn't common. It was like only like a couple schools had that. They were trying to instigate it, you know. But it was very common to still crumple up your paper. And it was the old iconic image of the frustrated writer was the trash can next to him with all the crumpled up pieces of paper like piling up, you know. You don't see that anymore.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's a shame. Do you write on paper or only type?
No, I don't. I, in fact, just last week did what I can't believe I haven't yet done, which is spill coffee all over my laptop and destroy my computer.
Oof.
And
did you lose work?
I didn't lose work. I had the most important stuff backed up. And luckily, I was just about to start writing that morning. That's why I had the coffee with me and I spilt it all over. But I knew it was all over as soon as I did that. I go, that's it. That's it. It happened. I shut it down. I went right to the Mac store immediately. Said, you gotta fix this. It's surely fucked.
Yeah.
And the guy opened it up and he goes, Jesus, it smells like coffee. I said, I know. Just fix it.
It's surely fucked is a nice way of putting it too.
Yeah, and it surely was. And the guy goes, you might as well just buy a new computer. And I said, how much is that? And he said, oh, for this one, it's like $1,200. And I said, well, how much is it to fix it? He said, it's $950. I said, well, then I might as well not buy a new computer.
Right,
you
right.
might as well fix it.
Yeah.
And quit giving me a hard time about the smell of the computer. I'm sure people bring in computers that smell
right.
of much worse things.
Yeah, and at least, you know, it'll keep the people up while they're fixing it.
Yeah, it'll be like crystal meth addicts in the back tinkering with my machine. And that sounded weird, tinkering with my machine. You know what I'm saying. Yeah,
The laptop.
Danny LaBelle.
Yeah.
Jesus.
Sorry.
So that happened. And then so I didn't have it for 8 days. I couldn't write for 8 days. You know, I got a deadline I got to meet for my manuscript. And I was like, well, what? I can't write. I don't have the internet.
Yeah.
Hemingway couldn't write without the internet.
Right, right.
Sinclair Lewis couldn't do it without a computer, right?
Right.
How could you possibly write without one? So I read actually for 8 days. I read 20 books in 8 days.
You did not
nothing
pick up
else
a pencil.
To do.
You wouldn't do it or a pen.
I did do it, but I was like, Jesus, this is just not doing it.
What about a typewriter? Wouldn't that be fun?
Yeah. But then I know I'd spill coffee on the typewriter. I'd bring it to the Apple store. I'd say, fix it. It's surely fucked. And they said, yeah, it's a typewriter. The keys are all stuck together and you need a new ribbon. How much will that cost? $950. You might as well buy a new typewriter.
What kind of coffee was it? Was it like a regular Folgers, like instant coffee? Was it fancy hipster coffee? What kind of coffee?
It was a coffee grounds from Trader Joe's. Mm. So it was halfway between hipster coffee and Folgers
exactly
in your cup.
Exactly the halfway point. Yeah. That's, wow.
Yeah, $4.99 for a nice thing of grounds. I use it functionally. You know, to wake me up in the morning. Mm-hmm. If I'm going to have a nice coffee, I'll go somewhere. It's not going to happen at my house.
Right.
So no. And I think if it was a high-end coffee, maybe it wouldn't have been so disrespectful of my computer, so essential to me.
If you would have spilled higher grade coffee on it, it would have, first of all, it might have actually improved the computer.
Yeah, precisely.
But if not, you might have got less guff at the Apple store. Maybe that's what it was. He could detect that you weren't getting Apple-worthy coffee. Like, wait a minute, our users Our customer base is supposed to be using higher grade coffee than that. This is PC user coffee that he spilled on a Mac.
Could be.
Get a whole new computer, start from scratch, Cliff. You don't get the mentality that Steve Jobs put down for us.
I couldn't believe this motherfucker. Yeah. He was just a kid. He said, you might as well buy a new computer. And I said, you know, and I think other people said that to me too. Oh, you should just get a new computer. I've had it for 7 years. I went to pick it up after it was ready, after 8 days. And the guy said, so it's actually a lot less than what they quoted you. And I was like, oh, how much is it? $95. Literally 10 times less than what they quoted. I was like, you wanted me to spend $1,300 and the repair cost $95 and it works fine right now.
Wow.
I mean, that's ridiculous to me.
Anyway. Sometimes you got to gamble. That was a real gamble for you there. You rolled the dice?
No, it wasn't a gamble because I didn't have $12.99 in my bank account. I had like $951.
Okay, so you had no choice.
It was a no-brainer, yeah.
So maybe it was the universe dictating the right decision for you to make. Had you had the extra money, who knows, you might have thrown away a perfectly good machine.
Yeah, could be. You know, I was just listening to your episode that you did with Bill Burr, and he said something that was really kind of profound, that his brother told him what having money is. Having money is going to the mall and being able to afford whatever you want, and then walking away and buying nothing.
Yeah.
I love that. That's such a great perspective. You know?
Except for people who own malls.
They're all owned by the same people that dictate which words
get
put into the dictionary each year.
Not a word, please, sir.
Shopaholic, now a word.
And when
food court, no longer hyphenated.
Somebody's in the middle of a game of Scrabble somewhere in the world. At the exact moment when that word becomes a word, and they put that word down, and at the beginning of the game, it wouldn't have worked as a word.
Right.
But because you're now an hour into the game, and within that hour, that word became a word, you can use the word. Now, do you count that word, or do you say, no, you can't count it until next game?
It's one of the great controversies of our time that you've just brought up. One of the absolute great controversies of our time.
It might have happened.
Get the word out and ask.
Because you know what happens when you're playing Scrabble. Sure. That's not a word. Yes, it is. And you go look it up, and someone says, oh, it just became a word 22 minutes ago.
Yeah.
It's official.
Right. Well, do people Google that now, or do they still have to use the official Scrabble dictionary? It might be dependent on which official Scrabble dictionary you have next to your game board.
A very good question. A very good question indeed.
Yeah, I bet the internet doesn't even play into Scrabble tournaments at this point, except for bloggers updating the stats that we are so... riveted by.
Scrabble people are the last ones holding out for no internet. We will play organically.
Yeah, they're more of those people that we don't need to hang out with.
All right. Well, you ready to jump into the philosophy?
Yeah, let's do it.
Like you and I were discussing before the show, you and Marc Maron, you're in a club, an exclusive club of people who got to pick their own philosopher. And I like that because I'd rather have somebody know something about them as I go on.
Right.
And when I first started the show, I was more interested in neither of us knowing and discovering together. But now I'm more interested in maximizing the learning. So I guess I've shifted my philosophy on learning philosophy. Mm-hmm. So I'll read you the bio for Bertrand Russell. Bertrand. Not a very masculine name.
No, he's very British.
Yeah. You never imagine that name in Brooklyn with a bunch of kids. And
really? You would, like Bert?
Yeah, maybe shortened to Bert.
But with a U, it would be in Brooklyn. It would be with a U, Bert. A truck driver named Bert.
Hey, Tony, Danny, check out Bertrand over here.
Yeah, not Bertrand.
Not Bertrand.
But Bert works. Like Bert Young, the character actor, always played those Brooklyn guys.
Maybe, yeah, I guess. Bertie.
No. Bertie? Where the fuck does that... Where did you hear that?
That's King's Speech, I think, right?
Yeah, I don't think that was ever uttered in Brooklyn.
Yo, Birdie.
Yeah, not a lot of golfers in the
Vinny,
Bronx.
Danny, Birdie.
Yeah, but...
You'd have to add a Y, right?
Yeah.
I don't know. Bertrand Arthur William Russell III.
Jesus. Right there. It doesn't get much more British than that.
Yeah. Bertrand Arthur William Russell III, Earl Russell... Lived from May 18th, 1872, to February 2nd, 1970. He was a British nobleman, a philosopher, a logician, a mathematician, a historian, and a social critic.
Historianician?
Historianician. a pediatrician. At various points in his life, he considered himself a liberal, a socialist, and a pacifist. But he also admitted that he had never been any of these in a profound sense. He was born in Monmouthshire. I'm going to say it. The more English I make it, the more acceptable the way I'm reading. Monmouthshire, into one of the most prominent aristocratic families in Britain. All right. Russell led the British revolt against idealism. That is probably one of the least bloody revolts of all time. In the early 20th century, he is considered one of the founders of analytic philosophy, along with his predecessor, Gottlob Frege, and his protege, Ludwig Wittgenstein. He is widely held to be one of the 20th century's premier logicians. That's like something you'd see in Vegas. Come and see one of the 20th century's premier logicians.
Bertrand Russell.
For a limited time only at the Mirage Hotel.
But first, the comedy of Danny LaBelle.
Hey, everybody. I know most of you are here for the logician part, but let's see if we can get a few jokes in. And that's not even how I talk. I've created a fake character for that show.
Well,
hey, yo, you know.
It's hard to be yourself when you're opening for a logician. It's hard to do your regular act. It just doesn't appeal to that crowd.
Thank you. Most people don't understand that. They're like, why aren't you being more real? I'm like, you don't know the logician circuit.
No. The pit boss had a talk with you after the last show.
See, these people, they're not into that shit. They're not into that shit, kid. You gotta go for the logician type stuff. You gotta know your audience.
That's so well done. I'm gonna keep hearing that.
The pit boss.
Yeah,
little pit boss that lives on every stand-up comic's shoulder when they play Vegas.
Kid, you gotta know your audience. They don't want to hear about this shit.
How many years has he been doing this? How long has he been in the business?
The pit boss.
Yeah.
Oh, he's been whispering in the ear of Steve Rossi and Marty Allen way back. Yeah.
Hello there. They don't want to hear that shit. They don't want to hear hello there.
Yeah.
That catchphrase will never swim.
Always fascinating, these people that have been around comedy forever.
Mm-hmm.
And they have so much like to tell like a young comic, but they've never done it themselves.
Oh, yeah. That's the worst, yeah.
All right. Back to Bertrand.
Yes.
Bertrand, where were we with him?
Logician, pediatrician.
Oh, the logician circuit. Yeah. He co-authored with A.N. Whitehead, Principia Mathematica, an attempt to ground mathematics in logic. His philosophical essay on denoting has been considered a paradigm of philosophy. His work has had a considerable influence on logic, mathematics, set theory, which is, you know, when they're building a set for a show. Like in theory, I think it should
right.
look.
In theory, we need this much plywood.
What is set theory? Do you know?
No idea. I'm not familiar with this, the mathematic aspect of him. Mm-hmm. I'm more familiar with Bertrand Russell as a member of, like, I am no philosophy scholar, so I'm sure I'm using all the wrong terminology, but I'm aware of him as more a member of the sort of rationalist or reason school of philosophers. Mm-hmm. I really enjoy reading his philosophy because it makes sense when you read it. There's no strain of your mind, and it's not that it's simple. It's just he's got such great grasp and clarity of what he's trying to convey. So mm-hmm. Bertrand Russell has all these essays that are full of points that you and I would already acknowledge and agree with, but mm-hmm. would never be able to articulate ourselves.
Interesting.
And he articulates them with such clarity that it's revelatory to read sometimes.
Cool. Well, I'll tell you what set theory is.
Please.
You want to hear? Set theory is a branch of mathematical logic that studies sets, which are collections of objects. Although any type of object can be collected into a set, set theory is applied most often to objects that are relevant to mathematics. I'm even more in the dark about set theory now.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think Bertrand Russell wrote this wiki entry. Yeah.
It would have been much...
He would have had clarity, yeah.
So he also... His works were influential in linguistics, in artificial intelligence, cognitive science, computer science,
wow.
and philosophy, especially the philosophy of language, epistemology, and metaphysics.
Pretty impressive resume there, I would say.
Yeah.
That's quite the crowning endorsement.
He was a prominent anti-war activist. He championed anti-imperialism. He went to prison for his pacifism during World War I. For his pacifism. This is again that there's that non-bloody revolt again.
Yeah. No, he was a brilliant iconoclast in that sense, because he rejected the idea of the First World War as being a ruse simply to profit the war makers. Mm-hmm. He was convinced that it was a ruse by profiteers in terms of the West's attitude towards Germany, that it wasn't in any actual coming from any kind of sincere place for championing any kind of so-called freedom. He just simply saw it as a way to enrich a small group of people. It was right.
Yeah. I don't think this war is rooted in enough emotion.
It reminds me of the color blue.
Yeah. Here's a nice thing. He campaigned against Adolf Hitler, then criticized Stalinistic totalitarianism. He attacked the involvement of the United States in the Vietnam War. This guy was on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm.
He was an outspoken proponent of nuclear disarmament. In 1950, Russell was awarded the Nobel Prize in Literature in recognition of his varied and significant writings in which he championed humanitarian ideals and freedom of thought.
I think he got the Nobel Prize for Literature because there was no Nobel Prize for philosophy, I think. And I think at the time it was like the first time that a person like that got a Nobel Prize for Literature who wasn't considered, you know, a novelist or somebody of that.
He was a trailblazing genre. Motherfucker.
He was, I'm sure this is buried somewhere in that wiki entry.
Yeah.
But one thing that's interesting, he was already like a noted philosopher, you know, in 1930. He got a professorship at NYU. I think it was NYU. Maybe it was Columbia. In 1930-31, as like a professor in residence, whatever. They stripped him of his post and he was deported back to England because at the time he was a very vocal advocate of sex education. He thought it was very wise to teach young people, to teach children in kindergarten and first grade about sex, how the body works, prevention of disease and contraception. He was a big advocate of all of that in 1930-31, and it was so controversial with the church. There was this huge campaign against him. He was stripped of his post at NYU, and he was deported back to England. He was kicked out of the United States, which is incredibly remarkable. All that anti-war stuff didn't bother anybody, but as soon as he said maybe people should pull out before they come or use a condom, he was deported.
Yeah, it's interesting. He really was ahead of his time.
Big time, yeah.
Russell described himself as an agnostic, saying that he could not disprove the Christians' God's existence, the same way he could not disprove the existence of Zeus. He thought of religion as superstition, and although it can have positive effects in the world, it's a harmful thing. It engages fear and dependency in believers and holds back new knowledge from them. This, in turn, sets the scene for religious wars and oppression. One way he argued against the existence of God was against the first cause argument. This argument states that if everything has a cause, there must be a cause for everything except for the thing that created everything. Yeah, which I've heard, which is God. Russell argued that if God can exist without a cause, then things can exist without causes, and maybe the world is one of those things, thus not needing a God to exist.
I like that Bertrand Russell used the phrase, maybe it's one of those things. That's my kind of a philosopher. Say, Lord Russell, could you tell us about so-and-so?
It's one
of those things.
One of those things.
Thank you, Lord Russell, the third.
I don't know if that was a direct quote of him or if it was paraphrasing it, but let's say he did
say
that.
He sounds
because
like
I like
he
it.
Sounds like a cool dude. The one thing that isn't cool about Bertrand Russell, when he started in his work, I guess in the late 1800s, and since he was raised in this bourgeois British culture, this imperialist culture, he was so-and-so the third, he came from wealth, he did not have the most enlightened attitude towards other races at that time, in like the 1890s. He eventually rebuked his early writings around 1920 and said, I don't believe some of the things I used to say. He was almost, without the concept of eugenics being fully established, I think he kind of veered in that direction. And there was some kind of international philosophy conference. I don't remember where I read this, like 10 or 15 years ago, where people that are really into philosophy or self-proclaimed philosophers convening. Mm-hmm. And every year they have a different theme for the conference. And this, several years ago, the theme was, is this the year we can finally acknowledge that Bertrand Russell was a racist? Because it's this like really tenuous thing, because he's this brilliant mind who seems to be on the right progressive side of things, but his very early writings in the 1890s, there's stuff in there about the superiority of the white race versus the savage races. But by 1920, he had already washed his hands of those early writings, but they did exist.
At least he could admit he was wrong.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. And admitted that he was wrong in 1920, just as blackface was flourishing. So that takes a bit of a perspective and balls compared to others, I guess.
I don't like the argument against religion about, you know, it causing wars, because I feel like it's not religion that causes wars. It's the people. It goes back again to his reason for a war not being, you know, in that case, it's to sell weapons.
Right.
If people want wars, they're going to have wars. And blaming other external things. Sure, you could say, oh, well, religion made me feel superior to this person, but you could.
Right, right. It's like being in a bar and the fight is over a girl.
Right.
But the guy who's starting the fight is probably a guy who starts fights all the time anyway.
That's how I feel right. about it.
Yeah, well, that's valid, yeah.
Even if it's a religious war, I don't think it's really a religious
right.
war.
So what do you consider the germination?
Well, it's usually about money, I think. It's about power. It's about land. Yeah. And religion, because...
Do you think religion is used as the auspices to conscript people to get right. pawns to right. fight for you who yes. normally wouldn't?
Yes, but I think that that's just perverting a system, and that all systems are pervertible. So
in America, they don't wage religious wars, but they wage wars often under the auspices of nationalism and patriotism.
Yes.
So it's kind of the same ruse.
Right. Whatever you can get the people to rally behind.
Right.
And people gotcha. Want to believe in something, whether it's religion or state.
Right.
Anything. People want to believe in something, and that's human nature.
Right.
So once people have any kind of belief, religious or not, you can then use that to manipulate them
right, right.
for your
It's
cause.
Interesting. America is, generally speaking, a very religious country, but seldom do you see it used as the excuse for war, even if, like, George Bush used the phrase the Crusades, and it was like a crusade against, is not against, whatever that sentence was that was controversial that he used at the start of his administration before the Iraq War. He said, we're going to wage a crusade.
Yeah.
Seldom are American wars that I know of ever waged with a religious mandate. Mm-hmm. But there is always that mandate of we have to do this for our freedom, which is almost like saying in a different context in a different country, we have to fight this war right. for God. You know, it's like this absolute and abstract that people do rally behind, you know, put bumper stickers on the car, I'm fighting right. for freedom, you know.
Right, right.
Whereas that is just like an intangible, meaningless sentence. It's completely subjective what that means. And of course you don't shoot a gun and say, now I've acquired freedom. I suppose you could if you were in a jail cell and you shot your way out.
When people are uneducated or limited in their education and oppressed and poor, you know, probably the same as oppressed.
When you're desperate, you're more easily manipulated.
Yeah, and when you're undereducated. When you're undereducated and desperate, it's probably not too hard to get you to do anything.
Right, 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 right.
Especially if a bunch of people are enthusiastic around you and you feel right. feel part
of
something.
I just watched a Tyrone Power film noir where he was working in a carnival, and it starts off where this guy is screaming and everybody has to go and like hold him down and tie him up.
Mm-hmm.
And Tyrone Power, who's just been hired by the circus, goes, what's that guy's problem? And the old drunken carny goes, oh, that guy? He's the geek. He bites the heads off chickens. And Tyrone Power goes, God, how could anybody get so low that they would do that for their job? And then, of course, the movie happens. Tyrone Power falls on hard times. His wife leaves him. He becomes an alcoholic. He breaks his back doing some circus stunt. By the end of it, he has no money, and he has the shakes. He has the DTs. Mm-hmm. He goes to this carnival. He goes, I need a job. And the guy behind the desk, you know, puts out the bottle of scotch. Have a drink. So what kind of job are you looking for in the circus? You can see where this is going.
Yeah.
I can swallow swords. We don't need a sword swallower. Well, we need, I could juggle. We don't need a juggler. but we are looking for a geek. And then, of course, the camera zooms in on his eyes, and he's all shaken and disheveled. And he goes, yeah, okay, I could do that. And then he becomes a bite the head off a chicken guy. And people in desperate, dire straits will do things that they otherwise would not.
Now, we alluded to the fact earlier that you're... this is a good point to bring it back up, because not too many of my friends are probably watching much film noir, but you are... a historian, you're writing a book on the history of comedy.
I am writing a book on the history of comedy.
What is your...
I may not be a historian, but...
Well, you're not a historian?
I don't know. I mean, you write about history, you'll be described as a historian, but I've never described myself as a historian. I was just a writer, just writing, so...
It's the same as being an artist in a way. You don't want to call yourself an artist. You want other people to call you an artist.
Well, there's that. Well, no, I don't want other people to call me a historian, because then I'll be held to a higher standard than I would otherwise want to be.
Same as being an artist.
Yeah, nobody holds any artist in any standard.
I feel like if you're just, you know, expressing yourself freely with art, that's one thing. As soon as everybody's like, oh, he's an artist, there's pressure on you, oh, to produce art.
Maybe. If I get described as a historian, then there's this pressure for accuracy. Not that I would ever try to emulate something inaccurately.
Right.
But I mean, there is a higher and different kind of standard than if I'm simply just writing. So, for instance, and this is going to be the most pretentious analogy possible, and believe me, I'm not comparing myself to him in any way, but Martin Scorsese, Goodfellas, Raging Bull, Mean Streets, The Aviator, The Wolf of Wall Street, which just came out. I'm trying to think what others of his. Those are all period pieces. Gangs of New York takes place in the 1890s. All of those movies take place at a different point in time than now, but nobody calls Martin Scorsese a historian. The Aviator is the true story of Howard Hughes. Raging Bull is the true story of Jake LaMotta. Gangs of New York is a true story, basically. So, but nobody would ever call Scorsese a historian. They just call him a filmmaker. Mm-hmm. So I kind of feel like I'm doing the same thing with comedians. I'm writing about comedy, and I'm telling true stories that happened in the past. They're not distorted. They're not inaccurate. But I don't think I'm a historian telling them. I'm a writer telling stories. And one of the distinctions that I have that I think that other historians do not, what would separate me from being a historian, is that if I find a story boring, I don't include it. Whereas if you're a historian telling the story of Eddie Cantor, you include everything. You include his whole life, beginning to end, boring, interesting, everything. I don't. I skip all the boring stuff and just put in the stuff that's interesting. So I think for that reason, I can't be described as a historian, and I don't want to be described as a historian. You know, I'm a writer.
Well,
but it
I'm
all,
not going to
describe all,
you that way
of course,
ever
it's
again.
All, it's all mirrored in history. I'm not saying that as a combative thing. I'm just
I know,
saying
I was
general.
Making it into that.
Yeah. And I'm sure Bertrand Russell would say the same. If you were here right now.
I'm not a historian, I am a philosopher.
Or historians would all omit the black people. Where is yours, Cap?
The history of civilization started with the whites and it ended with the whites.
At the very least, he wouldn't capitalize the word black.
I would never capitalize the word black as a logician.
That's one thing that sets you guys apart for sure.
I, Bertrand Arthur Russell III...
you want to read some of his stuff?
Yeah.
All right, cool.
Should I do it in my voice or his voice? A bit of both? Probably my voice.
I'll leave it up to the artist. The artist historian.
To the historian.
The art historian.
Perhaps the simplest and easiest to understand is the argument of the first cause.
And then it goes into parentheses almost immediately. Mm-hmm. He spoke in parentheticals. It is maintained that everything we see in this world has a cause, and as you go back in the chain of causes further and further, you must come to a first cause, capitalized first cause. And to that first cause, you give the name of God. That argument, I suppose, does not carry very much weight nowadays because, in the first place, cause is not quite what it used to be. Sounds like an old man, like on a rocking chair. In the first place, cause ain't what it used to be.
When I was a kid, cause was... Anyway, go on, sorry.
The philosophers and the men of science have got going on cause, and it has not anything like the vitality it used to have. But apart from that, you can see that the argument that there must be a first cause is one that cannot have any validity. I may say that when I was a young man and was debating these questions very seriously in my mind, I for a long time accepted the argument of the first cause until one day at the age of 18, I read John Stuart Mill's autobiography, and I there found this sentence. My father taught me that the question, who made me, cannot be answered since it immediately suggests the further question, who made God? That very simple sentence showed me, as I still think, the fallacy in the argument of the first cause. If everything must have a cause, then God must have a cause. If there can be anything without a cause, it may just as well be the world as God, so that there cannot be any validity in that argument. It is exactly of the same nature as the Hindus' view that the world rested upon an elephant and the elephant rested upon a tortoise. And when they said, how about the tortoise? The Indian said, suppose we change the subject. The argument is really no better than that. There is no reason why the world could not have come into being without a cause, nor, on the other hand, is there any reason why it should not have always existed. There is no reason to suppose that the world had a beginning at all. The idea that things must have a beginning is really due to the poverty of our imagination. Therefore, perhaps, I need not waste any more time upon the argument about the first cause.
I like poverty of the imagination.
Poverty of the imagination. That's a great insult, you know.
Yeah.
Some guy's fighting with you over your girl in the bar. And you go, yeah. Sir, I do not wish to indulge in fisticuffs due to the poverty of your imagination.
He's like, oh, I'm very imaginative.
What did you see about my imagination? Well, you son of a...
You ever hear people ever say, I can't even imagine.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, well, I guess you can't.
Yeah, I guess you can.
I can.
The poverty of your imagination does not infect my own imagination.
You must have a very poor, I can't even imagine that, poor imagination.
I can't even imagine, yeah. Should I go for another Bertrand Russell quote? There's
I wanted, before we keep going with him, I wanted to ask you about going back into the history of all these old-time comedians and the book that you're writing.
Yeah, sure.
What attracts you to it? Why do you think you have this passion that so many others don't have?
Well, it was all by default. I've been asked that question a couple times since, especially by the old comedians that I interview, because I'm like a third of their age. I'm not half their age. I'm like one-third their age, a lot of these guys. So they ask me that, like, how did you get into old comedians? And it was kind of by accident because I used to collect records, all records, like music, garage rock and soul records and soundtracks. And if you go to thrift stores, if you go to Goodwills and Salvation Armies, you find comedy records, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's certain records that pop up again and again. The ones by Bob Newhart, Bill Cosby, Jonathan Winters, 2,000-Year-Old Man, Von Meter's The First Family, which is like obscure today but was the best-selling comedy record of the day. Alan Sherman, the Jewish song parodist. Certain people just pop up again and again in the thrift stores. Rusty Warren and Woody Woodbury, these two people who are very obscure but are in every thrift store. So for 50 cents, I would buy comedy records just like I would buy soul music or whatever and amass this enormous collection and would listen to these comedy records that often did not strike me as funny at all but were recorded in front of a live audience in a nightclub. And you would read like the liner notes and one after another would say recorded live at my such and such hotel at Miami Beach. And then you'd read another one recorded live at such and such hotel at Miami Beach. And I started thinking, what the fuck was going on in Miami Beach? Everybody's recording their comedy records in Miami Beach. Yeah. Well, it turns out that once upon a time, Miami Beach was the highest concentration of comedy venues in America. It was like a resort town and all the comedians played it during the winter seasons. You know, there'd be like 20 or 30 shows a weekend, all featuring different comedians, some very famous, some half famous, some not that famous. George Burns, Milton Berle would play it. They're super famous. Jackie Mason, George Carlin would play it, but they were coming up. And then there was other guys that just never really made it, just like half names, you know. So collecting records is what hipped me to all these old comedians. And that kind of just intrigued me a little bit. And I also wondered why a guy could be so ubiquitous in the thrift stores, a guy like Von Meter or Woody Woodbury, and yet I have, as a comedy fan in general, as a kid, has never heard of him or seen him, and yet his records are everywhere. And what's that all about?
Does it bother you?
No, it doesn't bother me, but it intrigued me. I was like, well, obviously this guy was famous somehow. somewhere at some point, and now he's not. So there's a story here.
Right.
And you used to do a comedy magazine. Very briefly, I did a zine. Mm-hmm. When I was doing stand-up around 2004, I started the zine. And one of the things I did was track down this guy, Woody Woodbury, whose records I did not find funny. It wasn't for me, you know. It was a lot of street jokes, actually. But he had all these comedy records, and I wanted to ask him, like, well, what's your story? You know, like, you're everywhere in the new and used shops. What's the story here? Turns out he was just a guy who did kind of risque blue material, and that's why he never crossed over in the 50s and 60s. You couldn't do risque humor on TV or in movies. You could only do it not on the radio. You could do it on records, and people could buy it privately from behind the counter, and you play it at a party, and he'd be talking about women's knockers. Oh, knockers.
Yeah.
The audacity. And I got into the history of comedy through the comedy records. That's what led to it. And then when I started writing more and more after stand-up, it just was kind of a natural thing to kind of write about. Wrote about Woody Woodbury, wrote about Shecky Green, wrote about Rusty Warren, all these sort of half-forgotten names. People in a thrift store would recognize the name Rusty Warren or Woody Woodbury, but would know nothing about them. You or I know the name Shecky Green, and we know the name Shecky is completely associated with comedy. And if you adapt the moniker Shecky and go on stage, everybody immediately associates with you being some kind of old-time comic, like a hack comic, like a Henny Youngman, Take My Wife, Please. Everybody, there's this instant recognition. But none of us have any context for why that is. Where did the name Shecky come from? Is that a real person? Mm-hmm. If so, who is he? What did he do? So that became kind of a curious thing for me to explore, and that's what I do now.
It's funny. It's like when I put my CD out, I was excited because it's a little bit of immortality, and that's sort of proves it, what you're saying. It's these guys sort of lived on because of their albums. Had they not put the albums out, their history would be gone and forgotten.
Completely, yeah.
So it's that one piece of recording. It's that one day of their life which made their whole life immortal.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That's one of the appeals of show business, is creating immortality through a movie, through TV, through whatever the medium that you dabble in or decide on. And that's why everybody's always shooting for that big movie. I got to get that series, because you don't want to be remembered as just the next door neighbor who did two episodes of Benson.
Right.
You want something more than that. And I think it, even if it's not explicitly articulated, I think tacitly in our minds, we all kind of have that drive that what we want is immortality, because we know our days are numbered and we're all going to be in the dirt soon.
Yeah. Oh, good way of putting it.
Yeah.
I get the sense sometimes that people I know are more interested in being remembered than existing in the time that you know them.
I think that's almost a universal thing. I don't think most of us live in the day at all. And, you know, New Year's passed recently and people were saying, oh, this is going to be my year. Last year sucked, but this is the year. And that's it's the wrong attitude. There was a great radio commentator. He wasn't a comedian, but he was funny. This radio commentator in the 50s and 60s and 70s named Gene Shepherd. He's the guy who narrates the movie A Christmas Story. You know, A Christmas Story, the lamp, the leg lamp. That's him. That's his story as a kid, and then he narrates the movie. Well, he was on radio in the 50s and 60s and 70s. He has this one quote. It's one of my favorite quotes of all time that I think speaks to that. And the quote is, the great American myth is that the past was great and the future is going to be better. It's only the present that stinks, you know?
Yeah.
Good things used to happen and they're going to happen, but they're never happening right now, ever. You know, that's kind of a trap that I think almost all of us get stuck in all of the time. And the things that end up being great memories for us are things we never realized at the time would ever be a great memory. Like, oh, I used to love hanging out with that guy at that place. Those were good times. But at the time, it just seemed like, I want to do something else.
Because you wind up remembering only the good parts. Which is kind of like the way you write. You're filtering out the boring parts.
Yes.
Basically.
There's a lot of tragedy in my writing. Tragedy is interesting. And I think struggle is the theme of my work. I write about comedians struggling. So in my book, I have sections about... my book will be out probably this time next year. Struggle is a big, big theme in it. So I have a section about Larry David. I talk about Larry David's stand-up career. So everything that's in there is Larry David from like 1973 to 1983, but no reference to Larry David after 1983. It's just not as interesting because we know the story there. But we don't know the story of his struggle. We don't know the story of the failure. And I think that's fascinating and the most kind of relatable thing. We can all relate to the struggle. We can't all relate to the success. So I'm trying to write about the struggle of Woody Allen before he became a filmmaker, the struggle of Larry David. I have a section on the early Fred Willard that just talks about Fred Willard in the 1960s, what he was doing as a performer then, appearing on the Ed Sullivan Show four times, which you would think would make Fred Willard a big star. It took another 10, 15, 20 years for that to happen for him. So that's kind of the theme of my book, the early Conan O'Brien, how all the critics hated him and they wanted that show canceled as soon as it hit the air. Mm-hmm. The early Jon Stewart before he was doing talk shows. The early years of all these guys is kind of the most compelling. Okay. Religion is based primarily upon fear. It is partly the terror of the unknown and partly as the wish to feel that you have a kind of elder brother who will stand by you in all your troubles and disputes. Fear is the main source of superstition and one of the main sources of cruelty. To conquer fear is the beginning of wisdom. It almost sounds like that JFK plagiarized Bertrand Russell, doesn't it? To conquer fear is the beginning of wisdom. Let a kind of elder brother... I can't do a JFK, but it sort of sounds... Fear is the main source of superstition.
You're Larry,
and one of the main sources of cruelty.
Your Larry David does stand alone, though, as the single best Larry David impression I've ever heard.
That's funny, because I never knew that I did a Larry David impression until somehow you mined it out of my...
Really?
My larynx, yeah. What were we talking about that I ended up talking about Larry David, or like Larry David?
I don't remember. Can you read this as Larry David? I don't want to put you on the spot.
Jesus.
If it's not,
yeah, you might have to cut this out because I don't know if I can do it on the spot. Religion is based primarily upon fear. It's probably the terror of the unknown. And probably the wish to feel. So wish to feel. You have a kind of elder brother who will stand by you all your troubles. I can't do it. I'm losing it. But
it's not as spot on as it was last time, but it's still the essence of it is there.
It's hard to do him. It's hard to do Larry David's voice if he's not like
worked up.
Worked up, yeah, exactly. It's almost fear. Fear is the main. You got to wag your finger like you're in somebody's face. Fear is the main. It's one of the main sources of cruelty. It is. It is one of the main sources. You don't ask it. It's one of the main sources.
You know, it's really damn good. With a little bit of work, it could be great.
You know, in all my years doing stand-up, I never, ever did impressions.
Uh-huh.
But I've learned, and I'm sure you've learned this too, funny people can all do at least one or two hilarious impressions, bang on.
Uh-huh.
Even if they're not doing them in their act, like off stage. I haven't met one funny person who can't just do one killer voice that just totally nails somebody.
I wonder what that is. And you know what else I noticed? Comedians tend to do impressions of comedians.
It's so much fun.
Yeah.
It's so much fun to do impressions of comedians and people that you know. That's the other thing. You know, I'm very good at, if I ever have a job, there's always somebody at that job I can do an impression of. And it always, you know, everybody gets a huge kick out of that.
Right.
I think stand-up also, there's that. You're around comedians and you hear their cadence so often. You're around the same guys. So there's a guy on stage and you've heard his bit 1,000 times. So you can do that bit verbatim in his voice. It's been embedded into your skull. You
pick up his rhythm.
Exactly, yeah.
I often wonder if you took like a rhythmist. Is that what you call him? A rhythmatist?
No, a logician is the phrase.
Somebody who can just do rhythm, right? Someone who's rhythmic.
Right.
I'm trying to come up with a word.
What is this? Rhythmistian? It's not even a word.
Get those guys in the room on the phone. I want this made into a word by noon. This must be turned into a word by noon tomorrow.
Yes, yes. Well, it's not a word. It's not. Is this a Scrabble dictionary change since we started the game? I don't think so.
There's got to be someone who knows those guys who's like in a conversation, you know, like a mafia guy.
Yeah.
You know, getting a rhythmician on the phone. Or what?
Maybe that's...
You know, he's a guy who works in rhythm. And then I go, that's not a word. Don't fucking tell me that's not a word. You know, gets on the phone.
I want arithmetician in the Webster by tomorrow. Don't fuck around.
I think you found it. I think that's the key. I think that is what's happening. That's how ginormous got in there.
So there's a ginormous portions of this place. What do you mean it's not a fucking word ginormous? It's a fucking word ginormous. Tell me, it's ginormous portions. You know what I meant when I said ginormous portions, don't you? Then it's a what?
Get me those fucking Webster guys on the phone. They owe me a favor.
Basically, that's all it is, though. If you, any word that you're using, if it conveys the thought that you're trying to get at and the person understands it, then it is a word, right? That's right. What a word is. It's a device to communicate effectively.
But it's like how they took away Pluto's planet status.
Right.
Like one day it was a planet, the next day, I don't even know you anymore, right? You know?
Well, that's because somebody fucked up royally. Like the guy who decided it was a planet, whatever that scientist's name is, he has no credibility anymore.
Right. Or it was really personal and we just don't know.
Could be.
Somebody pissed someone off and was like, you know what I'm going to, you know how to hurt him the most? Yeah. You take away Pluto's status. Because if there's one thing this guy loves, it's Pluto, the fact
NASA,
that it's a planet.
NASA office politics are just, they're just so bitchy.
So finding somebody who's really good with rhythm and getting them to listen to different comedians and really develop the rhythm of each comedian. And then you listen to the rhythm. Do you think you could pick out the comedian? Like through just through rhythm? Just through.
Yeah, actually, I'm trying to think of somebody who I do.
Rodney Dangerfield, a very distinct rhythm.
Well, I can't do Rodney Dangerfield, but there are people you could do an impression of without using words at all, just by the guttural sound. Because so much of an accurate impression is the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
You got to hit that pitch if you have the right tone. I can't do a lot of impressions of people that have really deep voices. I just can't get deep enough.
Right.
And Rodney Dangerfield's actually one of them. So I can't do Dangerfield. You can do
it.
I
can do Rodney Dangerfield. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I can't do it. But
no
yeah.
respect, Cliff, I tell you. Boy.
Yeah. You could even just take out that no respect and just... and you basically have it.
Oh, yeah. There you go. You know who that is.
Yeah, you, Jackie Mason. Yeah, same thing. I'm trying to think who else. I can do Bill Burr.
Okay.
Dude! There you go.
Woody Allen.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. There are people that I can do like that. It's just not coming to mind. W.C. Fields has a bit of that. It's a common one. That was a hack impression in the 30s to do W.C. Fields. All right. I was doing it in the shower the other day. I was singing, what was I singing? Oh, Bohemian Rhapsody.
Yeah.
But in W.C. Fields' voice.
It's
sounds
not,
like a hack.
When did it stop being hack?
Yeah.
It was hacked from 1930 to 1935, at which point it became okay. By 1942, funny again.
All hack impressions get replaced by the next hack impression. So it was W.C. Fields impressions. They got replaced by James Cagney impressions. James Cagney impressions got replaced by, I'm not sure who. And then Jack Nicholson impressions came along. They got replaced by Christopher Walken impressions.
Yeah.
I think we're still at Christopher Walken impressions right now in terms of hack mentality. But I haven't been in a comedy club lately.
In the history of impressions.
Yeah, I think we're still at the Christopher Walken stage. It hasn't yet been purged.
I wonder if you have a greater sense of the world that you live in, especially as a comedian, than most of your peers, because you just have such an idea of where it came from to where you are.
That's what history does. It gives you context for everything. And it is kind of an excellent, not coping mechanism, but understanding device of things that are going on. You can see it unfolding and you already know how it's going to end because you've seen it happen before through history.
And you can probably recognize character archetypes and different personalities.
Absolutely. There's one thing that you don't see much of in comedy anymore are comedy teams like the Smothers Brothers. But in the old days, you had that all the time. You had your Abbott and Costello, you had your Martin and Lewis. Smothers Brothers were really the last of the big comedy teams. Now you have comedy teams that are like, it's a gimmick because they're a team like the Sklar brothers. But generally speaking, you just don't see comedy teams anymore. However, one place you do see comedy teams is in disguise, and that's on late night talk shows with David Letterman, with Johnny Carson, with Jay Leno, because they play straight man to the comedian that's sitting next to them. So if you ever see Jim Gaffigan on Letterman on the panel, Gaffigan's just doing his act. He's just doing his act. He never does anything other than his act. But Letterman will say, "Now, Jim, I understand you just got back from vacation." "That's right, David. I did just get back from vacation." He goes into his vacation bit. That's what comedy teams used to do in the 50s and 60s. Like two guys in tuxedos would be on stage. Say, Jim, I just heard you got back from vacation. Why, that's right. I did just get back from vacation. Yeah. Then they do the bit. So comedy teams live on, but in a different form, like in disguise. You see it on the late night talk shows. Jon Stewart does it when he interviews a comedian. They all do, you know, they play straight to it. So it's interesting the way things evolve and don't evolve. But with that context, the background, you can identify things. That's all history is context. And everybody likes to have context for whatever they're getting involved in.
So I guess I definitely have a part in the history of podcasts.
So. Danny LaBelle, the man who claims to have the first ever comedy podcast.
Well, that's a tough claim, but at least to have interviewed big comedians on a podcast.
Sure. What year did your podcast start? 2004?
2004, yeah. It would be hard to find. I don't think anybody else was doing it at least on the level that I was doing it.
I'll tell you, there's three different people that claim to be the first person to do a comedy record. And there's always, when people are claiming to be the first anything, the first problem is one of definition. Like guys who claim to have invented hip hop. I was the first rapper. Well, what is the definition of that? You talked fast and rhymed, but was it hip hop? With comedy records, Mort Saul claims to have released the first comedy record. Although they recorded it in 55, it wasn't released till like 59. So there was like this weird thing. Red Fox, his first comedy records came out in 1957, but nobody heard them other than black people. Mm. Woody Woodbury's first comedy record, I think, came out in 59, and he claimed to be the first one. So Red Fox, it seems like, was the first stand-up comic to have stand-up comedy records out. But because he was black, it was only black audiences who heard them. So these white comics claim to be the first when he's probably the first. Then there's also the thing of people put out funny songs before, like novelty stuff, or 78s of radio shows like Amos and Andy. And does that count as a comedy record? So there's always debates around the first anything.
Right. Yeah.
But it sounds like you were the first comedy podcast.
Yeah. At least I've got some part in the beginnings of it all. I'll say that. That much I'm confident in.
So who would be your competitors to claim that crown?
Maybe, I don't know when Bill Burr started, but again, he wasn't interviewing people. I don't know. I think we have another quote. Should we do one more quote?
Sure. The fact that an opinion has been widely held is no evidence whatever that it is not utterly absurd. I like that.
Yeah, that's good. That's true.
Bertrand Russell was a very interesting, prolific philosopher. I mean, I'm not familiar with his writings on mathematics or linguistics. Strictly on his logician side, I think, is the stuff that I'm most familiar with. But it's all very interesting. In fact, he has a book about sex and marriage. I'm not sure if he's the one who chose which essays went into it or if a publisher put that together. But it's like 20 different essays about sex and marriage that were written in the 30s and 40s, and it is fascinating. It is awesome. It's just...
Is it a steamy read?
It's a very steamy read. It's a very steamy read. Bertrand Russell. Oh yes, Pip-Pip and all that. Oh yes, Pip-Pip.
If you can't get an old porno mag,
you can read
pick up some
Bertrand Russell and exercise your sexual muscle. Yeah. I'm the first rapper.
Yeah, very nice. Cliff Nesteroff, writer, historian-ish. And if it's not a word, we'll make it a word. Logician, magician. Do you do any magic?
No.
Can you do some in the act? Where's that guy when we need him? You know, the people want to see magic.
People want to see magic. You know, it's a logician crowd. They like the bunny in the hat. They like the Saw of the Woman, you know. I know the Saw of the Woman's an expensive trick, but, you know, the casino, if we sell tickets, we'll pick it up, you know. It's not a big deal. You choose the women. You know, there's this one broad in the line, you know. She's got great gams, you know. You could saw her up. I saw her up too, you know what I'm saying? No, you don't know that scene. That doesn't make sense. But, you know, logician, magician, you know, just throw some of that shit in there. You know, can you do like an impression? Like Jack Nicholson. There's this guy here with sunglasses the other night. He fucking brought down the house. He turns around. He's got his back to the stage. He turns around. He says, "Here's Johnny." You know what I'm saying? Let's try something like that. You know, logician, magician.
Obstetrician.
We had an obstetrician last month. He didn't draw.
They don't draw. I love it. All right. Thanks so much for doing the show.
Thanks for having me, Danny LaBelle. It was a treat.
There you have it, everybody. Thanks again to Cliff Nesteroff, my guest. Thank you guys for tuning into the show. Please make a donation if you can at moderndayphilosophers.net. $20 or more, you get those tweaked audio earbuds. And if you want to do something nice, it costs no money at all. Go on iTunes, leave a nice comment, 5-star rating. It helps. It really helps. So please do that. You can always email me, and I'm really, really happy when you do, at thecomical@yahoo.com. Say hello. Let me know what you think of the show. Anything, just send me an email, thecomical@yahoo.com. All right, everyone. Thanks again. Thank you very much for tuning in. Thank you for being with the show. Please, if you can, in any way, spread the word to your friends. And I will see you next week with a fantastic episode. I can't wait for you to hear it. Okay, have a great week, everybody. Bye.